Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
How deep? How deep, I ask, now not overloading the microphone. How deep? Deep in Columbus, Ohio. That's how deep, ladies and gentlemen. Where, you know, apparently there is a Newtonian thing going on. You can either have a ridiculously successful screening and Q&A of The Big Uneasy at a local theater, or you can have spring weather. You can't have both. So we had A. But boy, springtime in Columbus. It's time to light those fires. Now, you'd think after spending all his time making up with his maker and learning how to be a good dude from his third wife, Newt Gingrich would have learned a few things about defending himself in public. Now, fortunately, when he was on one of the Sunday Yak shows today, the moderator did not say, you and Osama bin Laden have something in common, three wives. That didn't come up in quite that way. But the moderator of that Sunday Yak show did confront Newt with a quote from Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma, which was published last fall in the Tulsa World, which I believe is a newspaper in Tulsa. Otherwise, it's the entire world. As seen from Tulsa, here's the quote of Senator Tom Coburn. Quote, Gingrich is a super smart man. Sorry. But he doesn't know anything about commitment to marriage. His life indicates he does not have a commitment to the character traits necessary to be a great president. And that was, you know, displayed in front of Newt for him to parry, which Gingrich did by, you know, saying, well, I've had to discuss things with my maker. And never occurred to him to say, excuse me, and I'll say it, not just in Newt's behalf, but in behalf of common sense. Senator Tom Coburn, man who judges others on the basis of their knowledge of their commitment to marriage. When Senator John Ensign, who recently announced his resignation from the Senate because of a little marital thing he was having, where he was having an affair with the wife of his closest aide, who was in fact a girlfriend back to high school days of his wife. You know, not too messy. When he was having trouble disentangling all this and trying to figure out how to make nice with his aide, like to get him a job, a lobbyist job or something that would, you know, provide a revenue stream that might compensate for the thing. And that was turning into trouble. That negotiation was turning troublesome and nettlesome. Who stepped in? What housemate at the C Street house, the house of prayerful members of Congress, who stepped in to negotiate the deal to get the husband of the mistress soothed monetarily? Senator Tom Coburn, of course. That Newt didn't occur to Newt to point that out. But Newt, you're welcome. Now, ladies and gentlemen, some things that we have been told we're okay, might not be okay. Fresh doubts have arisen, according to India Today. Because India yesterday is, you know, behind us. Fresh doubts have arisen about the safety of genetically modified crops, with a new study reporting the presence of BT toxin used widely on genetically modified crops in human blood for the first time. The genes extracted from bacteria to make them resistant to pest attacks are what make genetically modified crops so attractive to farmers. They make crops toxic to pests, but are claimed to pose no danger to the environment and human health. One of the toxins is a soil bacterium called Bacillus thuringiensis, BT. Till now, scientists and multinational corporations promoting genetically modified crops have maintained BT toxin poses no danger to human health because it breaks down in the human gut. Pardon me, ladies. But the presence of this toxin in human blood shows somebody was asleep at the gut. Scientists from the University of Sherbrooke, Canada, have detected the insecticidal protein circulating in the blood of pregnant as well as non-pregnant women. They've also detected the toxin in fetal blood, implying it could pass on to the next generation. The research paper has been peer-reviewed and accepted for publication in the journal Reproductive Toxicology. Damn, my subscription lapsed. The study covered 30 pregnant women and 39 women who'd come for tubectomy at a hospital in Quebec. None of them had worked or lived with a spouse working in contact with pesticides. They were all consuming a typical Canadian diet. I'm guessing heavy in carbs, but that's just me. That included genetically modified foods such as soybeans, corn, and potatoes. The toxin was detected in 93% of the... Now they get to the figures and it's very confusing. Now, 93% and 80% of maternal and fetal blood samples, there we go, respectively, and in 69% of tested blood samples from non-pregnant women. All right, then. That's from India Today. And from the Philadelphia Inquirer, Duke University study has found that methane levels in private water wells are on average 17 times higher in wells that are within 1,000 feet of a natural gas drilling site. They sampled the water from 68 wells in northeastern Pennsylvania and New York, found methane in 85% of the wells. The methane was fingerprinted. Sergeant Pryde doesn't know how to do that. The signatures matched the methane of the gas from natural gas wells in the region. At least some homeowners who claim that their wells were contaminated by shale gas extraction appear to be right, according to the peer review study. The authors said it was the first systematic evidence of methane contamination of private drinking wells in areas where gas extraction, pardon my expression, was occurring. So that's supposed to be safe. You know, where can you turn for certainty in such an unsure world? How about Disney? Because it's wholesome. What could be wrong with the wholesomeness of a Disney thing? Well, nothing really, except you may be getting in line to try to get some money from them, because the Walt Disney Company has trademarked the name of the Navy SEAL team that killed Osama bin Laden. The Disney Company has trademarked SEAL Team 6. The trademark application came on May 3rd, 2 days after bin Laden was killed, and 2 days after SEAL Team 6 was included in thousands of news articles and TV programs focusing on the operation. Disney's trademark application for SEAL Team 6 covers clothing, footwear, headwear, toys, games, and entertainment and education services. So get me some of those SEAL Team 6 hats and a SEAL Team 6 study guide, if you'd please. And by the way, make the check, folks at Disney, make the check payable to the federal taxpayer, won't you? Because that's the way capitalism seems to work. Hello, welcome to the show.
mais, nunca mais. De que servem as flores que nascem pelo caminho, se o meu caminho sozinho
Live from WCBE in Columbus, Ohio, I'm Harry Shearer, bringing you this edition of show. And I didn't mean to suggest that there's anything wrong with Disney copywriting, trademarking SEAL Team 6. It's just, you know, we American taxpayers invested some money in the whole SEAL Team deal, in SEAL Teams 1 through 5, which didn't, you know, pay off, apparently. And in the same way, let's put it that way. And it just, didn't Tang pay royalties to NASA? I'll look that up. Isn't Google paying royalties to the Defense Department for the Internet? I'm sure they are. And now, ladies and gentlemen.
He's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an inspector general. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Funny how that kind of works out that he is an inspector general after all. Ladies and gentlemen, nursing homes are unnecessarily administering powerful antipsychotic drugs to many elderly residents, including residents with dementia. According to a new report by the Inspector General for the Health and Human Services Department, because over-medicating kids just takes care of, you know, one extreme of the human age scale. The Food and Drug Administration in 2005 mandated that drug makers issue warning labels on atypical antipsychotics, noting that the drugs, which are approved for treating schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, increase the risk of death for elderly patients with dementia. Yet, when the government examined 1.5 million Medicare claims from 2007 for those drugs for elderly nursing home residents, the government found 88% of the time the drugs were prescribed to individuals diagnosed with dementia. Doctors and nursing homes aren't the only ones to blame, according to the Inspector General. The report does not specifically examine ties between doctors, pharmacies, and nursing homes, but in a statement accompanying the report, the IG, Daniel Levinson, faulted drug companies for aggressively and illegally marketing these products to doctors for treatment of dementia and other off-label uses. It's not illegal for doctors to prescribe drugs for off-label uses, but it is illegal for drug companies to promote them as such. That's why they're off-label. Quote, despite the fact that it's potentially lethal to prescribe antipsychotics to patients with dementia, there's ample evidence that some drug companies aggressively marketed their products towards such populations, says Levinson. He noted a number of drug companies have been accused of illegally promoting these drugs off-label to doctors and pharmacies, including those that serve nursing home residents. Those lawsuits, some of them have been settled. Levin said those settlements alone don't negate the effects of years of off-label promotions. Money, he says, can't make up for years of corporate campaigns that market drugs with questionable benefits and potentially deadly side effects for vulnerable elderly patients. Ending the quote. His report also pointed a finger. Oh, it's finger-pointing time. I hate that. At the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the agency that oversees Medicare and Medicaid, or maybe it just overlooks them, for failing to hold nursing homes accountable for unnecessary use of antipsychotic drugs. The federal government paid $116 million, more than $116 million for claims that violated Medicare reimbursement criteria for the first half of 2007. He recommends that the CMS assess its safeguards for preventing unnecessary antipsychotic drug use in nursing homes. The agency acknowledged better controls were needed. You got us. Busted. Hundreds of millions of dollars lost to fraud at Afghanistan's biggest bank, this again, could have been saved if foreign consultants hired by the U.S. government had not ignored obvious signs of trouble. Well, maybe they were trouble-ignoring consultants. Maybe that was their job. Did you ever think of that? The U.S. government watchdog, the Office of Inspector General at the U.S. Agency for International Development, finds highly paid Western contractors working in the Afghan Central Bank failed to raise the alarm even after they received death threats when they tried to audit the Kabul bank. Guess they just cared about living. The bank nearly collapsed last year after revelations that most of its money had been lent to its politically powerful managers and shareholders and their associates to fund reckless investments and beachfront mansions in Dubai. Somebody's got to buy beachfront mansions in Dubai. Not me. With losses estimated up to $850 million in an economy with a GDP of only $12 billion, it has been likened to a pyramid scheme and described by Western officials as, quote, the biggest per capita fraud in history. So Afghanistan has made it into the record books, ladies and gentlemen. We're busting our buttons over here with, is that pride? A report by that officer Inspector General reveals the private consultants employed by the U.S. government repeatedly stumbled across red flags, which they ignored. Even picking them off the floor, I guess. They include an incident in November 2008 when an expatriate advisor employed by Bering Point received two death threats after participating in a regular central bank inspection of the offices of Kabul Bank. The company responded by banning its consultants from taking part in any more inspections and limited its technical assistance to classroom training, because, of course, nobody would bring a gun to class. The report said that had inspections not been halted, the fraud could have been detected earlier, and the magnitude of losses would have been smaller. But then there would have been fewer beachfront houses in Dubai. Do the math, babe. The following year, the consultants failed to report the incredulous response of central bank officials when the foreign advisors told them that they, as regulators of Afghan's banking system, had the legal powers to remove the chief executive of Kabul Bank. On the contrary, said the officials, he can remove us. Thank goodness things don't work that way here. In other incidents, the central bank governor raised serious concerns to consultants picking up rumors about the Dubai property investments, which were ignored. Dubai, Shmubai, they were not heard to say. The criminal fraud, said the U.S., one of the U.S. contractors, was deliberately concealed by channeling illegal loans to individuals through fictitious companies. Oh, well, we would have no way of following that up. Thank God nobody else uses that ruse, or we'd be in big financial Even an audit by an affiliate of PricewaterhouseCoopers, the respected accounting firm, failed to find any signs of trouble, which is one reason why they're so respected, I guess. But that report, which I just shared some items from with you, may be the one that's fingered in the following story, an eye-opening report on corruption in the Afghan Central Bank, Oh, I see. This was Kabul Bank. In corruption in the Afghan Central Bank, that was the bank that's supposed to regulate the Kabul Bank, where they said, oh, no, no, he can fire us. That bank, a report on that was issued last March by the Inspector General for the U.S. Agency of International Development, was recently removed from that agency's website because the agency decided to classify some of the contents that had already been published on the interwebs. The now classified report focused on the failure to discover a widespread pattern of fraudulent loans at the Kabul Bank. All right, so it's the same basic mess. In the past week or so, that report was abruptly withdrawn from the AID's website. At the time our report was issued, it was written utilizing information from non-classified sources, says the chief of staff of the Office of Inspector General. After our report had been issued, USAID subsequently classified two documents that were cited in our report. The action resulted in the entire report being classified, and we removed it from the website. The classification of information that's already been officially released into the public domain is either discouraged or prohibited, according to Secrecy News, not to mention futile. A spokesperson for USAID did not respond to requests for comment on the decision to classify the information. Hopefully that's the response, and not that his statement has been classified, but we don't know. The suppressed Inspector General report remains independently available in its original form elsewhere on the Internet. The AIG says, we plan on publishing a non-classified version of the report, which we will place on our website. It's magic. It's almost magical. It's this close to magical, which is why we love it. News of Inspector General, ladies and gentlemen. It is, as you know, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now. And there's so much of this.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Save, cheap, too cheap to meet. Cheap, save, too safe to meet.
Well, look who came to Columbus, Ohio, our friend Addie, the Atom.
Hello, it's cold.
You shouldn't be cold. You make your own warmth, don't you? Yeah, he's sulking now. News, ladies and gentlemen, of our friend, the Atom, because there's so much of it today. Start with this. Japan won't be building any more nuclear plants. Prime Minister Naoto Kan said Tuesday Japan would abandon plans to build more nuclear reactors, saying his country needed to, quote, start from scratch in creating a new energy policy. That announcement came as Japan allowed residents of evacuated areas around the stricken Fukushima plant to briefly revisit their homes, just to get a dose. The decision will mean the abandonment of a plan the Kan government released just last year to build 14 nuclear reactors by 2030 and increase the share of nuclear power in Japan's electricity supply to 50%. Japan already has 54 reactors. The cancellation of the planned nuclear plants is the second time Kan has suddenly announced big changes in Japanese nuclear policy without the usual long committee meetings and media leaks that characterize the country's consensus-driven decision-making process. He appears to be seeking a stronger leadership role after criticism of this government's sometimes slow and indecisive handling of the Fukushima incident. What's that? That's that nuclear barn door he's closing. The operator of the Tsuruga nuclear power station in central Japan said this week a minute amount of radiation leaked from the plant. Japan Atomic Power said the radiation was released from Tsuruga a week after the operator found higher levels of radioactive substances in coolant water. Those are two separate incidents at this plant, nowhere near Fukushima, in 8 days took place amid growing public concern in Japan about nuclear. The Tsuruga plant is located on the west coast of Japan, some 500 kilometers. Anybody know what a kilometer is? Southwest of Fukushima, was not affected by the disaster. Meanwhile, here's an interesting little twist in Addie's race across the world. Japan and the U.S. are in negotiations, according to this report, negotiations with the Mongolian government over the possible construction of a storage facility for spent nuclear fuel. In answer to the question, well, why don't we just put it all in Outer Mongolia? The answer is, we're thinking of that. Officials from Japan's Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry and the U.S. Department of Energy held informal talks with their Mongolian counterparts to build such a facility shortly before Japan's earthquake, according to a Japanese newspaper, the Mainichi Daily. The plan would enable Japanese and U.S. nuclear plant exporters, including GE. Well, it's Mongol imagination. To better counter the challenge from Russian and French companies in the global nuclear market by selling reactors and nuclear waste disposal services together as a set. It's a match set. The plants and the dumps in Mongolia. In return, Tokyo and Washington would provide nuclear technology to Mongolia. Except for one thing. Mongolia says it's not true. Mongolia has not been in talks about importing nuclear waste from other countries, according to its embassy in Vienna. The country's 2009 nuclear energy law, quote, does not envisage import of nuclear waste from other countries, said the statement from the embassy. So I guess that means price wasn't high enough. Try again, boys. One of the reactors at the crippled Fukushima nuclear power plant has a hole in its main vessel. That's a good thing, right? Following a meltdown of fuel rods leading to a leakage of radioactive water, its operator said this week. But that's a good thing. Seriously, isn't it? It's got to be. Otherwise, why would they? The disclosure by TEPCO is the latest indication that the disaster was worse than previously disclosed, making it more difficult to stabilize the plant. The discovery of the leak provides new insight into the sequence of events that triggered the partial meltdown. The battle to bring Fukushima under control has been complicated by repeated leaks of radioactive water. Workers have been pumping water into at least three of the six reactors to bring their nuclear fuel rods to a cold shutdown, but after repairing a gauge in the number one reactor this week, TEPCO discovered the water level in the vessel that contains its nuclear fuel rods had dropped about 16 feet below the targeted level, which would cover the fuel under normal operating conditions. There must be a large leak, says Junichi Matsumoto, general manager of the utility. The fuel pellets likely melted and fell, and in the process may have damaged the pressure vessel itself and created a new hole. U.S. nuclear experts now say the company may have to build a concrete wall around the unit because of the breach, and this could now take years. But wait, there's more. There's so much more. Addy?
I'm ready.
Okay. Nuclear plant emergency generators like those that failed in Japan also failed during tests at the Seabrook station in New Hampshire and 32 other U.S. plants in the past 8 years, according to a report by a U.S. congressman who is opposed to nuclear powers, Congressman Edward Markey. This was issued during the same time frame that a federal task force vouched for the safety of the nation's nuclear plants. The Seabrook incident, according to the report, took place in August 2006 when the plant shut down because of inoperable emergency diesel generators. The generators were inoperable for just one day. The problem occurred when one of the two backup generators was taken down for routine maintenance and a voltage problem occurred at the other. It was quickly repaired, but NRC rules require the plant to shut down if a certain number of generators are not operational. The New York Times reported this week that despite repeated assurances that American nuclear plants are better equipped to deal with natural disaster than their ones in Japan, regulators said this week recent inspections had found serious problems with some emergency equipment that would have made it unusable in an accident. In addition, the staff at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission acknowledged the agency's current regulations and disaster plans did not give enough consideration to two factors that had greatly contributed to the disaster in Japan: simultaneous problems at more than one reactor, couldn't happen, and a natural disaster that disrupts roads and electricity and other infrastructure surrounding a plant. Couldn't happen. Coolant is escaping through a newly discovered opening at the Fukushima plant, a development that could slow efforts to prevent further potential radiation releases from the facility. And there's this. Bad news for Addie.
No.
Yes. The 440 commercial nuclear reactors in use worldwide, around the world, as Wolf Blitzer would say, are currently helping to minimize our consumption of fossil fuels. But how much bigger can nuclear power get? In an analysis to be published in an issue of the Proceedings of the IEEE, the International Electric and Electronics Engineers Organization, Derek Abbott, professor of both kinds of engineering at the University of Adelaide, has concluded that nuclear power cannot be globally scaled to supply the world's energy needs. Global power consumption today, he says, is about 15 terawatts. We know now tera from terabytes. He estimates to supply 15 terawatts with nuclear only, we would need 15,000 nuclear reactors. He explores the consequences of building, operating, and decommissioning 15,000 reactors on Earth. A nuclear power station is resource-hungry and, apart from fuel, uses many rare metals in its construction. The dream of a utopia where the world is powered off fusion or fission reactors is simply unattainable. Even a supply of as little as 1 terawatt, he says in his report, stretches resources considerably. First, simply finding 15,000 locations with enough land near enough water is challenging. Every nuclear power station, he says, needs to be decommissioned after 40 to 60 years of life due to neutron embrittlement.
Oh, yeah, I hate that.
Cracks that develop on the metal surfaces due to radiation. Then with 15,000 nuclear power stations, one new station would need to be built and another decommissioned somewhere in the world every day. Considering it takes 6.5 years to build a nuclear station and up to 20 years to decommission one, he finds this unrealistic. There's the matter of nuclear waste. It's uncertain whether burying the spent fuel and the spent reactor vessels, which are also highly radioactive, he says in his report, may cause radioactive leakage into groundwater or the environment via geological movement. Based on the accidents so far, 11 nuclear accidents at the level of a full or partial core melt, scaling up to 15,000 reactors would mean we would have a major accident somewhere in the world, major nuclear accident somewhere in the world every month. Maybe even in February. And then there's the matter of uranium. Abbott, in his report, says at the current rate of consumption, the world supply of viable uranium will last about 80 years. Scaling consumption up to 15 terawatts, the viable uranium supply will last for less than 5 years. And nuclear vessels are made of a variety of exotic rare metals. We'd run out of those, he says. In any future generation nuclear reactors, whether they're fueled by uranium or thorium, many of these same problems would plague fusion reactors. So he concludes, due to the cost, complexity, resource requirements, and tremendous problems that hang over nuclear power, our investment dollars would be more wisely placed elsewhere.
What does he know?
Addie. Addie got his Addie up. Clean, cheap, safe. Too bad to meet her. Nuclear power, ladies and gentlemen. Addie, you going now?
Nah. I'll just stay here. Sulk.
You'll stay here and sulk.
She puts my body away next to the trash, under the sink, along with all of the cleaning supplies and the things that we buy and decide we don't need. It's damp and it's dark and it's lonely here next to the trash under the sink. But everyone needs time off now and then. So I'm happy my friends don't feel sorry for me. She says, if you're playing a game, I hope you know you're winning. And if you tell me you're next to the trash, I'll tell you I'm winning. Oh, well, why would you want me to touch you if you know I don't mean it? She's right, I'm mean when I'm bored, so I dig through the trash looking for her. She can wash herself off in the mist from the pipes. We could use more of that around here, that's for sure.
shore. But it seems whoever has thrown her away has forgotten the trash under the sink. Oh, was it a joke meant to buy her some time? All the citrus and pine make it harder to think. So I say, if you're playing a game, I hope you know you won't win it. And I'll be sorry if they threw you away, it's just that they didn't. She says, boy, you better take it back right now, and I mean in the gutter, but she pulls it out. And it's all part of having a man in the house.
This is Le Show from Columbus, Ohio. Think of it. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of changing his story, let's hope, as at least as fast as he's changing his underwear. General Pervez Musharraf, Pakistan's former military ruler, now admits that rogue elements of the country's intelligence service may have helped Osama bin Laden evade justice for years before he was shot dead by a U.S. Navy SEALs team, soon to be a Disney movie. In the first high-level admission that bin Laden may have had a support network within the Pakistani military establishment, former President General Musharraf, now in exile in London, and apparently liking the idea of coming on in the media with a different story every once in a while, says, quote, as a policy, the Army and the ISI, intelligence community in Pakistan, are fighting terrorism and extremism, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. A rogue element within is a possibility, unquote. Those comments will reignite suspicions of a shadow element operating within the military's inter-services intelligence, ISI, to further the cause of Islamic extremists. The links date back to the 1980s when Pakistani officers channeled arms to jihadi groups battling the Soviets in Afghanistan and continued as Pakistan armed militant groups to take on Indian troops in Kashmir. American officials have been convinced of the existence of a rogue ISI of retired and semi-retired intelligence agents. That's a good status since the attack on the Indian embassy in Kabul in 2008. At least at that time, one senior U.S. diplomat said that then President General Musharraf simply cannot rein them in. He has no control over them. And Pakistani officials denied the claims. Maybe he can. Maybe he can't. But you're aware that we became cognizant this week that following the operation of SEAL Team 6, soon to be a Disney motion picture, President Obama called former President Bush. And former President Bush said he was told reporters, not reporters, he was overheard by reporters saying to a group that he had been out having souffle with Laura at a restaurant called Rise when the call came in, and he said he had to go home to actually take the call, which may have sounded like this.
Retired Eagle.
Mr. President, you didn't gulp down your souffle, did you?
You know, it's great that a Nikon of evil is dead, but the best thing about this call is that you rescued me from having to eat that thing.
Well,
mean, I'm okay with French toast and all, but did you know that most of a souffle is just nothing but air?
Actually, I did know that. I wanted to give you a brief rundown of the operation as we understand it at this hour. Mm-hmm. Of course, most of what I'm going to tell you will be contradicted by our people within a couple of days. So,
I'm not going to share this conversation with anybody. That's okay. But, you know, I mean, charging folks $20 to eat air, that is so French. Mm-hmm. And these people at the restaurant, they're not even real French people. They're just West Houston people putting on airs, literally. Mm-hmm. So how'd it go?
Well, pretty standard seal op. Firefight, human shield, resistance, shoot to kill.
Uh-huh. Where'd they get him?
Third floor bedroom.
No, I mean, where on him?
We think he was shot in the eye.
Isn't that weird? Mm. That shake that was behind the first attack on the World Trade Towers? He was blind, wasn't he?
Mm.
And now this. Tells you something, 44.
Yes, it does.
You're going to go into the terrorism business, you can look forward to losing an eye or two.
You'd have been very proud of the SEALs, Mr. President.
Hey, I'm even proud of you. Tough call to make.
Yes. Yes, it was. They gave us only about a 50% chance of getting him.
Huh. And the other 50% was...
not getting him.
Right. Right. Got it. Well, you sure chose the right 50.
Yes, sir. You know, we saw a real-time video feed from Langley, the reception problem when it was killing time.
You know, I heard back when we approved the appropriation for the helmet cams, the electronic focusing on the weapons is going to screw up the reception on the cameras. But, you know, the Pentagon people just said we'll spray some stealth juice on the helmets, they'll be fine.
Stealth juice?
Yeah, that's what they told me it was called. Heck, what am I, some jet pilot or something? Actually, I am.
Well, sir, you can imagine what it was like watching these very brave men enter the compound in the middle of the night.
Yeah, sure. What was it, middle of the night, their time or yours?
Theirs.
Yeah, and I can't imagine. You're still awake for it.
Mm, to say the least.
Yeah. Well, look, it's just the two of us. Mm. I'm cleared.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead and say the most.
Right. Well, of course, you know, their intel doesn't tell them where in the compound he'll be.
Damn intel. See, that's why Dick had to keep going down to Langley and kick some keister.
So, as they start taking fire, camera work gets very shaky.
Yeah, see, that's one reason we were funding the advanced Pentagon research on the special ops robots. In other words, they don't flinch. Camera stays steady.
They secured a bunch of hard drives, computers, seized a pantload of useful intel resources. Uh-huh. We've got an urgent recruiting call out for some Arab speakers so they can translate this stuff.
Did Bin Laden say anything? Was there any "okay fellas, you got me" moment there? You know, that would have been sweet.
Yeah, it would have been. Frankly, I don't think he had a chance to say much of anything. They saw him. He backed up. It happened quicker than a Derrick Rose dunk.
Quicker than a who? What?
I just don't think we ordered the Navy SEALs there to engage in conversation with a man, even if any of them could have spoken Arabic. Anyway, just wanted to...
I guess all that enhanced interrogation we did kind of paid off after all.
Well, you know, funny thing about that...
Guess you're kind of glad you didn't close Guantanamo, all the new evildoers you're going to be rounding up after this.
Well, you know, got to put them somewhere... Yes, sir.
Is that indefinite detention thing going to turn out to be a little more handy than you used to think?
We have had reason to dial back our criticism of that down past the zero point. That's true.
Well, sir, don't worry about it. If we didn't live and learn, there'd be no reason for putting pencils on erasers.
Well, you got that right.
Well, listen here. You get that tape off of those cameras developed or whatever, you sure would appreciate getting a copy down here. It'd be fun to... hit the couch and watch that some night. Get Laura's mind off souffles and all.
Oh, absolutely. In the pipeline already. We're converting it to HD.
Great. Well, 44, thank you for all the heads-upness.
Well, you'll be getting a full CIA brief in the morning.
I'm sure if there's anything crucial in there, Cheney will pass it on to me.
I'm sure he will. Good night, Mr. President.
Good night, Mr. President.
And now, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Dayline Martinsburg, West Virginia. A Republican contender for governor of West Virginia has apologized to the NAACP and anybody else he offended when he referred to President Obama as Sambo, and U.S. House Minority Leader Nancy... Tom?
House Minority Leader?
That's it. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi as a bimbo. Former Berkeley County Delegate Larry Faircloth insisted he was only joking at a recent candidate's forum and told a local newspaper that he's neither a racist nor a sexist. He said he was joking during a discussion about Obama's re-election bid when he suggested Obama replace Vice President Biden with Sylvester Stallone, then make his campaign slogan, Vote Sambo, Rambo, and Bimbo. Non-professionals doing comedy, ladies and gentlemen, always good. Southwest Airlines' customers of size policy has come under fire once again. You do know what that policy is. Mother and daughter were stopped at a gate in Dallas where an airline employee deemed the pair too fat to fly. That's the policy. Passenger Kenley Tigman and her mother were pulled aside during a layover on Easter Sunday. The employee told Tigman, who apparently has lost 120 pounds over the last 2 years, they were too heavy for the flight. Yet the employee could not state Southwest's actual rate restriction policy that requires passengers to repurchase a second seat when of a certain size. That's because there isn't any such policy. The customers of size policy only states the armrest is the definitive gauge for a customer of size. It serves as the boundary between seats. Customers who are unable to lower both armrests and who encroach upon any portion of the adjacent seat should proactively book the number of seats needed prior to travel. Tigerman announced, recounted the experience in a long entry on her blog, which also contains photos of her dramatic weight loss. The account on her blog caught the attention of a Southwest executive who reached out to her and apologized for the incident. In a post-game comments following the Heat's, Miami Heat's 97-87 win over the Boston Celtics to cement their 4-1 victory in the Eastern Conference semifinals of the NBA, LeBron James apologized for the way he announced he was going to Miami last year in a much ballyhooed and much ridiculed television hour called The Decision. He told reporters he was sorry for how the special occurred, but felt that teaming up with two other players in Miami was necessary to get past the Celtics. I apologize for the way it happened, but I knew this opportunity was once in a lifetime, he says. Deadline Beijing. Despite its every guard, a theft took place at the Forbidden City in Beijing on May 8th. 7 items have been stolen, and spokesman for the tourist attraction, Feng Nian, apologized this week to the public and made a commitment to beefing up security. First, I apologize on behalf of the Forbidden City Museum. I'd like to apologize to those who care about the Forbidden City Museum, he said. Also, on behalf of the Forbidden City Museum, I would like to apologize to the Madame Liang Sikang Museum, or Liang Yikang, sorry, Museum, and its sponsor, Mr. Feng, sorry. The second museum was one that had lent some priceless treasures that were stolen. Atlanta Braves pitching coach Roger McDowell addressed a small group of reporters this week at Turner Field on his first day back to the club after a 2-week suspension handed down by Major League Baseball after McDowell allegedly used anti-gay slurs against San Francisco Giants fans last month. He did not use the word gay at any time during his press conference of apology, nor did he admit or deny the allegations. He did apologize again for his actions and said that kind of behavior, whatever it was, would not happen again. Dateline Frankfort, Kentucky. State Senator Julie Denton, Republican of Louisville, tearfully apologized this week as the Legislative Ethics Commission criticized her for skipping most of the ethics training required of legislators during the past 4 years. The commission took no formal disciplinary action, but its chairman, George Troutman, told Denton he was displeased she missed 6 of the last 8 mandatory ethics sessions, and then told a newspaper other legislators don't take the sessions seriously either, sometimes signing in and then leaving immediately from the ethics classes. Because they can. Dateline San Diego Police Chief William Lansdowne apologized this week on behalf of his department for a record spate of officer misconduct cases and pledged to do everything possible to regain the public's confidence and repair the damage. And the author of a Houston Press post with the inflammatory title, The 10 Hottest Women on the Sex Offenders List, has apologized and offered an explanation of why he would put people convicted of crimes against children on such a list. Apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now quickly, news from outside the bubble. The former communications director of the Tony Blair Labor government has now been accused by a former military intelligence chief of misrepresenting the purpose of the so-called dodgy dossier. This was a dossier of materials that was brought forward by the Tony Blair government to build the case for the Iraq War in September of 2002. Major General Michael Lowry, Ministry of Defense's Director General of Intelligence from 2002 to 2003, took issue with Campbell's saying that the purpose of the dossier had not to be had not been to make a case for war. He said, telling the Chilcot Inquiry, which is looking into the Iraq War in Britain, that making a case for war was, quote, exactly its purpose. He and his colleagues were told that a previous intelligence dossier did not make a strong enough case, and for months he was under pressure to find intelligence that could reinforce the case for war. His evidence, the first time that such a senior intelligence officer has directly contradicted the Blair government's official line on the dossier, will restart the controversy over whether the Blair government sexed up the September 2002 document to persuade the public and Parliament that the invasion was necessary. The Major General's comments were made in private last year and have only now been published by the chairman of the inquiry, along with newly declassified British government memos. I and those involved in the production of the dossier, says the former intelligence chief, saw it as exactly that, to make the case for war, and that was the direction we were given. He said his boss, the chief of defense intelligence, often asked, quote, whether we were missing something. He was under pressure. We could find no evidence of planes, missiles, or equipment that related to WMD. During the drafting of the final dossier, every fact was managed to make it as strong as possible. It was clear to me that there was direction and pressure being applied on the Joint Intelligence Committee. We knew at the time the purpose of the dossier was to make a case for war rather than setting out the available intelligence, and to make the best out of sparse and inconclusive intelligence, the wording was developed with care. There was a previous dossier that was rejected because it did not make a strong enough case. And finally, in news from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, good news for people whose cell phones may have been peeked into by tabloid newspapers. Good news for anybody who just wants to get some money from Rupert Murdoch. Actress Sienna Miller has accepted $65,000 compensation from the Rupert Murdoch-owned News of the World newspaper, after it accepted unconditional liability for breaking into her phone. The unexpected agreement came midway through a high court battle with the paper. The celebrity is the first one to settle a claim since the tabloid last month admitted hacking the phones of several public figures. The settlement is the highest privacy award to date. News Corporation, Rupert, will also pay Sienna Miller's legal costs. I guess there was stuff that they didn't want to have come out in a trial, don't you think? News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, it is a copyrighted feature of this very broadcast. Something will happen soon. Like this. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank the whole gang at Real Time with Bill Maher for a lovely time last Friday night. It's still being rerun. If you got that pay cable thing. Got to talk a little bit about The Big Uneasy. And thanks to everybody here in Columbus for a great screening, great Q&A. The Big Uneasy last night. The picture continues in Columbus. Opens tonight. I'll be there in Cincinnati tonight for a Q&A. And then tomorrow night in Louisville. And The Big Uneasy opens in Los Angeles and New York this coming Friday. Information about the film, TheBigUneasy.com. That's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world via the American Forces Network. No other forces, I guess, get to listen to it. On the Mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want it, or live, harryshear.com and kcrw.com. On the Mighty 104, did I mention the Mighty 104? Yes, I did. Up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant, WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz shortwave. On your smartphone, getting smarter every day, which is why I keep it a safe distance from me. Available for your smartphone, I say, at Stitcher.com, and available as a podcast, free to you, from me, at KCRW.com. It'd be just like all that stuff being safe, if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. Uh-huh. A tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks to the whole gang here at WCBE. They're having a party in the next room as we speak for their help in originating today's broadcast. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. The email address for this broadcast and the list of music heard here on the playlist, as we call it in the biz, just some of the delights awaiting you at harryshearer.com. And the show is on Twitter at The Harry Shearer. Join the 34,000 followers. And try to turn them into leaders if you can. That little piece of music was shorter than I think anybody on the planet expected. So here we are, ladies and gentlemen, just for me to close out the show by dragging out the final words as long as humanly possible. Won't you join me? The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions. It's a limited liability corporation, not incorporated in Delaware, I'm proud to say, and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica. Santa Monica? I'm so glad you asked. It's a community recognized around the world, that would be the planet we live on, as, and this is a sobriquet I've given to it for good and plentiful reasons, known as the home of the homeless, won't you? So long from Columbus, Ohio.